projects. And we'll be doing that either tomorrow or Tuesday, depending on how long it takes us to go through the proposals that we have tomorrow in front of us. Before we begin hearing proposals, I wanted our new committee clerk, Eric, to introduce himself to everyone. Eric, do you want to just say a few words about yourself?
Oh, I'd love to. Hi, I'm Eric Diedrichson. I recognize a few of you from the Healthcare Access Commission, which was a hoot this fall. I interned in their office this fall, and then I get the joy and wonders of becoming the committee page this spring and working long hours and hanging out with Shelley and Shannon and our intern Rachel, who's doing my job for me right now. And yeah, I'm looking forward to meeting all of you and having fun, or at least trying to. So, yeah.
Thank you, Eric. And Rachel, did you want to introduce yourself also?
Sure. I'm Rachel. I'm the intern in Senator Berglund's office. I just graduated from the University of Wisconsin-Madison with a degree in international studies and Spanish. And so I'm just trying to get a little taste of the political side here, and I'm enjoying myself so far.
So we really appreciate having both of you with us, and we do have a lot of work that we do in my office and to get ready for these meetings, and these folks are invaluable in helping us with that. Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, I would just also say you can see how important you are. You're sitting way up front, and we're way out here in the cheap seats.
But, Senator Coring, that's so I can see you better. we do have a group of people that have to try to get back today, and the weather is already starting to get bad. So I thought we could start with them. And they are from the White Earth Reservation, Irma Visner, and the folks that are with her to present the proposal for the White Earth Juvenile Treatment Facility. Members, when you leave today, just in case anyone has to leave early, if you could leave your materials here, we'll be adding to them for tomorrow's meeting. So we'd appreciate if you leave your books here. Go ahead.
Thank you,
Welcome,
Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm here with Senate File 2507, a bill we introduced late last year with a request for the White Earth. One of the issues that we're dealing with across the state, but particularly in northern Minnesota, is treatment for our youth that have mental health and other issues. And we have think that White Earth has found a way to improve the treatment, to save some money, and to really improve the way that some of our young people are preparing for their adult life. And I'm here today with Ron Valiant from White Earth and the chair of the White Earth Band, Irma Visner. And if we can get the technology worked out here, we will have a PowerPoint to give a little more information to what the Gilfillan Center is. But briefly, they do have the opportunity to purchase a residential facility and school for young people in the Bemidji area that they would use to provide treatment for the young people of not only their reservation, but White Earth, or Red Lake and Leech Lake and other reservations across the state. So I think with that, I could turn it over to Irma, and she could talk briefly and see if we can get the PowerPoint going up.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Senator Skoy, and thank you, Chair Berglund. And members of the committee, thank you for, we appreciate so much the opportunity to be here first on the committee hearing this morning because of the weather. Thank you very much. Very briefly and very quickly, our PowerPoint looks like it's not going to work, but we're going to go ahead. I believe you all have everyone has a copy of the...
They're going to hand them out.
They're going to hand them out. What we have last October, the Senate Bonding Committee did tour the Gil Fillon Center in Bemidji, and so some of members of the committee have seen the facility that White Earth is interested in purchasing to serve the large number of Indian youth throughout the state of Minnesota. And it is our goal to provide treatment facility to serve our youth who are in the correctional system at a disproportionate high rate of nearly half of those youth in the juvenile correctional system are Native American youth. We believe that incorporating cultural and spiritual components into a treatment program will provide the effective intervention, and it would be open to all tribal youth from all 11 reservations throughout the state of Minnesota, possibly Canada, and the urban areas here. We have a large population of Native American youth in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area as well. Our goals would be to provide the comprehensive intervention services to juveniles and to limit their tendency to go into the adult correctional system. This facility would be unique by incorporating our historical context, our strong family connections, which are very, very important in our Native American culture, to coordinate with the school curriculums on the reservations, and to provide, which is very much needed, appropriate diagnostics and assessment, and to work with our tribal elders in the treatment of our children. Our program would focus on ages 12 through 16 years of age, court-ordered placements. We have also work with voluntary placements by family working with case managers. The family participation programs for those juveniles approaching release is part of our program. The aftercare services for juveniles released from the facility would be developed in cooperation with probation and social services. Those younger than 12 would be addressed through a community and family health family program. And as we go through here, let's see, the facility is located within the city of Bemidji. It is owned by the Episcopal Church, Episcopal Community Services. It's well maintained. However, there are some upgrades that need to be completed in order to meet the criteria for the Department of Human Services. We will follow state standards on the facility requirements. It will house, we have 5 residential units there, housing up to 71 beds with a school building, a swimming pool, shop, and classrooms. There's also recreational facilities for softball, volleyball, basketball. It has a swimming pool, and it has administrative and support buildings as well. The appraised tax value of the property at the last assessment was $4,500,000. At this time, we're waiting for the final appraisal. We've had to do an environmental assessment and also to the survey. So that has delayed the appraisal. The Episcopal Community Services is the management board of the facility, and they have been moving this along very quickly to meet our legislative calendar as well. But at this time, it will be at least another 2 weeks for the final appraisal. We have talked to the Episcopal Diocese of Minnesota, and it will be no more than $6 million. And this is a wonderful opportunity for and a much needed service for our Indian youth, and a wonderful opportunity cost-wise for the tribe. Let's see what there is a school that the Bemidji School, there's a school on the premises for about 80 students, and it's being currently leased by the Bemidji School District, and I have met with the school superintendent. We will continue that relationship and serve our tribal youth at the facility within the Bemidji School System. Education is it's very important to continue and be consistent with the educational process. Right now, the property is, except for the upgrades on the commercial kitchens that we will have to put in place, it's a turnkey operation. And for those of you who have toured it, it's a very, very well-maintained place. It's the as greatly needed as we need treatment facilities for tribal youth. We could not build a facility with the land for $6 million. It was Weidert's original intention to when we received the $50,000 last year from the state legislature to conduct a feasibility study, that we would be looking for a piece of property centrally located where the three largest tribes are. Located in northern Minnesota around the Bemidji area, that we would purchase property and we would build a facility. Obviously, we could not do that for $6 million. So we believe that if our youth had culturally appropriate treatment services, that we would not have the disproportionate number going through the revolving door of the juvenile correctional system, and that is that the cultural appropriate treatment programs would be within our traditions, within our family, extended family structure, and also with our elders. All of these are strong threads throughout our culture that have been missing in the juvenile correctional system, and treatment programs that are currently that are currently available. Many of our youth are sent to South Dakota, North Dakota, Minneapolis area, far away from the family. And so we are working with very closely with the Department of Human Services. There is a team within the Department of Human Services to assist us with the licensing, the programming, the reimbursements. And I guess I would like to turn it over just to Ron just to explain very briefly about the reimbursement.
Okay, most of the reimbursement will be coming through the Consolidated Treatment Fund. Some of it will also be coming through MA. And also, there would be private insurances we would go after, too. Because we could go after some federal monies, we could go after different monies and higher amounts than what Gilfillan did, because they did run into some financial problems there. But, you know, by being a federally licensed school, we could go after higher reimbursement amounts. I don't think there'd be any problem once we get up and going of keeping it running in that, because we're looking at, you know, a sizable amount of money coming in and that. And this is a need that is just so important in that area. And I guess, you know, that's, you know, really all I have to say, unless somebody has specific questions.
The amount of money that you'll be bringing in for the operation of the facility, will it be enough to allow you to carry any debt service on the building?
Madam Chair, committee members, what we would like to do is put the money back in. We see such a need there. We would like to be able to expand it because we're looking at being able to handle about 70 residents, you know, at the beginning, and we see such more need. So it's going to be limited how much we could, you know, pay back, you know, for a debt service. But we'd like to be able to expand it eventually. But, you know, we're looking at years down the road yet before we really expand.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair and the panel, I guess that just sparked a question in my mind. I would think that, and somebody answered this question, but if you had the ability to service some debt, I'm wondering if there's a possibility instead of doing general obligation bonds, we could do maybe revenue bonds. Is that a possibility if they could show that they could service the debt on those revenue bonds?
Well, I wasn't thinking they could probably manage all of the cost. Mm-hmm. I just wondered if they could manage any of it out of as debt service. So, I mean, I just don't know. Obviously, if they could, there'd have to be two bonding, bonding proposals for them.
Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Coring, and Madam Chair. There is a question of ownership and bonding, and one of the benefits of having the tribe own this is they do have the ability to access approximately 100% of the cost from the federal government for reimbursements. But we, as a state, have a difficulty bonding for facilities that are not publicly owned. So we're trying to work through how we are going to and what available funding mechanisms there might be. We see this as a very good project. We think that the kids would be much better served, but we don't know that the state can bond for this yet at this point. We're trying to get the answers to that. It might be that we'd have to look for some other funding or general fund dollars even. But keep in mind that it is increased reimbursement levels. It would restore the 100 jobs that have been lost there in the Bemidji area and, would serve the children that the need is demonstrated much better than currently, I believe.
The other question that I had is there were actually two planning grants given out last session. The Senate funded one and the House funded two, and we ended up in the conference committee funding two with one-time money. And I guess I'm not convinced that we can create two facilities in that general area of the state. This facility is being requested to serve all three tribes up there, and one of the tribes is planning at this point in time their own facility. So that's a little bit of a concern to me, at least, that, you know, if that could get worked out so that all three tribes felt like this was going to serve all three groups of people, I think it would be a stronger proposal, at least. In my mind, it would be. Is there any progress that's been made on that front?
Where is it?
They have it at their desk. Has any progress been made?
Senator Olson?
Unresolved.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd first just like to thank Chairwoman Visner and Senator Skoy for their concern about, I would definitely concur that this is a need and a problem in our area that needs to be addressed. But as you know, last year I brought the bill requesting funding for Leech Lake, and they're on a two-year track in terms of planning for their treatment facility. And actually, this has been a plan that's been underway with them for quite a few years. I met with the Tribal Council last week, knowing that Chairman Visner was planning to bring this proposal here this year, and talk to them about the possibility of working together and possibly even through some type of joint ownership situation, because the problem that Senator Skoy mentioned, one possibility that had been mentioned to me in a meeting was some kind of a nonprofit organized where all three tribes would have representation and share responsibility for that facility. Leech Lake was very adamant, the tribal council was very adamant with that their wish is to have a facility located on the reservation property where there's access by the children in their area as well as the elders and others that will help to bring the cultural component to the treatment program. Again, this is something they've been planning and working on for a number of years. We didn't know about the Gale Fill-In Center when that proposal was made because they were still in business. But now that they do know about that, and I've discussed this with them, they're very adamant about continuing to move forward with something that they've been planning for some time located on Leech Lake Reservation. Leech Lake is actually only, I think, about 15 miles from the Gale Fill-In Center, and so they are the closest to that location. And that's basically all I can tell you. One thing I would add about the Gale Fill-In Center that hasn't been mentioned, though, is when the Episcopal Church talked about the reason that they hadn't been able to handle this financially or why it wasn't working out, they talked about originally when the Gale Fill-In Center was designed, it was to bring metro children out of the area and get them out of the situations they'd been in and bring them to a more remote location. Thinking has evolved a lot since that time, and treatment modalities have changed. So the idea now is to try to keep people close to their homes and their families. And it was kind of ironic that kids were coming up from the metro area to Bemidji, and then children in our area were being shipped off to South Dakota. So I definitely support the concept of a treatment facility there. I'm just addressing the issue that you raised to the best with the best information I have.
Madam Chair, just very briefly, I just want to give some background on the cooperative efforts with the three largest tribes in Minnesota, Red Lake, Leech Lake, and White Earth. We have over a year and a half ago, we formed a joint commission on economic development, and definitely our youth are a part of our long-term economic development plan. It was proposed at that time when we formed that joint commission of Red Lake, Leech Lake, and White Earth that youth would be a focus for our three tribes. So so that took place, those discussions took place well over a year and a half ago. The other point is last week, the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe, which comprises the six tribes in the, with the exception of Red Lake, Fond du Lac, Mille Lacs, Boyce Fort, Grand Portage, Leech Lake, and White Earth, passed a resolution in support of, you have that resolution, the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe unanimously supported this concept. So I think, you know, the need is there. Yes, we certainly respect our tribal brothers and sisters, our relatives of Leech Lake, but White Earth this should have been done 20 years ago. We cannot allow opportunities here to continue to allow our children to go through these getting lost in the system of non-productive lives. I just ask, you know, that we look at something expedient and correctional and interventional right now. Thank you.
Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Question. Thank you, Senator Skoy, and perhaps the panel could also answer. Why did you have to have an environmental assessment? You know,
Madam Chair, committee members, Senator Rosen, mm-hmm. Anytime there's a purchase like this, and it's going to be a federal program and that, we need an environmental assessment to make sure there's no hidden gas tanks, anything like that in there. So before they could actually do the appraisal, they had to make sure there was no contaminants on the thing, because that would definitely be detrimental to the appraisal. So that's why we had to do it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Now, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Now we have a proposal from the Minnesota Department of Health, Minneapolis-St. Paul interconnection.
Morning, Madam Chair. My name is John Stein. I'm the Director of Environmental Health for the Minnesota Department of Health. With me today at the table are Shaheen Rezania from the Minneapolis Water Works and Steve Schneider from St. Paul Regional Water Services. The proposal that is before the committee this morning is a proposal regarding the interconnection of the two major regional water systems that service the communities of Minneapolis and St. Paul and surrounding suburbs. And there was a blue folder that we provided that contains information about a little bit of information about the service areas and the project orientation. The Minnesota Department of Health Environmental Health Division is responsible for administering the Safe Drinking Water Act in Minnesota. The Safe Drinking Water Act was passed by Congress in 1972, and it is our responsibility to oversee the implementation of that act on behalf of the EPA. It's called primacy, just like the Pollution Control Agency administers the wastewater treatment components of the Clean Water Act. So the project proposal that has been forwarded has been discussed for a number of years, going back to the 1930s. The two systems, the two major water systems that service the areas of St. Paul and Minneapolis and surrounding suburbs, are currently not connected, and this project would facilitate an interconnection between those two water systems to provide redundancy of supply in the event of emergency and to provide for public health and safety in that event. The project cost is approximately $40 million, and the two regional water systems have come together with a request to seek $10 million in state funds to assist in completing the project. This project was included in Governor Pawlenty's Clean Water Cabinet proposals, but is not currently in the governor's recommendations for bonding this year. I also would note that this project has received a significant amount of discussion at Metropolitan Council discussions about regional water supply planning. And the Metropolitan Council's report recommends that projects of this type that would increase the redundancy of supply for public health and safety in the urban areas and in the metropolitan area be considered for state funding. And so the Metropolitan Council's report does include a recommendation to that effect. And lastly, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security does place a high priority on water system security projects for the future. This project has not yet been funded by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, but those funds are continually being sought as they become available. But at this time, they've not been provided. With that, I'd like to have Mr. Schneider and Mr. Rezania give a brief overview of the project, what it entails, and then stand for questions.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you very much for having us here this morning and being able to talk to you about this project. I've been general manager of the St. Paul Regional Water Services for the last 5 years, and this is one of those projects that was ongoing when I took the position, and we continue to try to seek the funding necessary to make this project happen. The project itself, as Mr. Stein indicated, is relatively simple in design, although $40 million is not a small amount of money to do it. It's because we're in a developed metropolitan area. It involves some modifications to our facilities, one of our reservoirs, the installation and building of a pumping station, and a large pipeline between the St. Paul and Minneapolis systems through through an area of our service area and into Minneapolis's service area. Operations and maintenance of the system would be developed through a joint powers agreement between Minneapolis and St. Paul. We would each take on some of those responsibilities for the long-term operations and maintenance. So this request is strictly for the capital investment of the project. It's not for the ongoing maintenance that can be brought into our individual operation and maintenance budgets in each system. As John mentioned, we do provide water on the St. Paul side for the city of St. Paul and all the first-tier suburbs, a total of over 415,000 people on a daily basis. Our system is designed such that it is a standalone system for Minneapolis. It's internally redundant. In other words, small issues happen from time to time that we're definitely able to handle. Our treatment plant is internally redundant, where we can do our ongoing maintenance by shutting half of the plant down and operating the other half of the plant. But, you know, the reason for the interconnection project is for those types of incidents that are major, a major natural disaster or a major man-made disaster at our treatment facility. So with that, I'll turn it over to Shaheen, and he can talk a little bit about Minneapolis, and then we'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. What I would like to add, I think Mr. Stein and Mr. Schneider covered everything, but really one of the issues we have in the metro area is that except Minneapolis and St. Paul, that we use the Mississippi River as our source of water, the suburbs that they have their own water system, they use groundwater. And the projection of the population increase in metro area is that another 1 million people by 2020. And expecting that most of those people would end up using the groundwater, that to me is a major issue with respect to limited resources in groundwater. And by having this interconnection between Minneapolis and St. Paul, we are looking at offering our service to other suburbs in terms of the water that they might use from the ground. We can use it from the surface water. I look at Mississippi River as a resource that is leaving the state, and we are not really tapping on it. It's the amount of the water we take from this river is not even 1% of the flow. So I feel that with the situation with groundwater, it's very important to tap on that surface water as much as possible.
The project, it's indicated the cost of the project would be between $30 and $40 million, but the request is for $10 million. So where does the rest of the financing for the project come from?
Madam Chair, committee members, the Board of Water Commissioners of St. Paul has indicated support for the project. The intent is to continue, as Mr. Stein talked, to search out federal funding through Homeland Security and have the ability within our capital budget to come up with the remainder of that project cost. Back in 2003, yes, we completed a study that came up with the basic design cost. That's where the $30 to $40 million came out. That study actually was $34 million. And during that, there was a cost split that was developed between Minneapolis and St. Paul based on the inherent risks to each system. And each of us have the ability to come up with that remainder of the funding, but we will continue while we're in the design process. And having these additional local funds dedicated to the project will hopefully be able to leverage that at the federal level and to get additional funding as well.
Are there other questions? Guess not. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Department of Human Services had a request that was not in the governor's budget also regarding the Moose Lake Sex Offender Program.
Good Madam Chair, my name is Wes Koistra. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Chemical and Mental Health Services at the Department of Human Services. And with me is Alan Van Buskirk, who directs plant management for state-operated services. We originally presented four proposals to the for bonding that included the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. It included system-wide asset preservation, system-wide campus redevelopment, and the remodeling of the Anoka West Wing Miller Building. And I understand that you would like us to go through each of those, mm-hmm. regardless of whether they're part of the governor's recommendation. And so Mr. Van Buskirk will cover the specifics of those proposals and will both be available to the committee for questions.
Madam Chair, members, with that brief introduction, I'll start with the department's original priority number one, and that's the Minnesota Sex Offender Program expansion, phase two. This is a request for funds for the construction to furnish and equip additional residential program and support service capacity for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program at Moose Lake. This is the second phase of a two-phase project implemented in 2006 to expand the Minnesota Sex Offender Program bed capacity by 800 beds. The 2006 legislature appropriated funds for phase one of the Moose Lake expansion. Building construction began in July of 2007 with completion scheduled for phase one in the spring of 2009. Phase one will provide new secure residential treatment space to accommodate 400 additional new patients at the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. It does not provide adequate or all of the support ancillary support service space to support those 400 beds. That support space is part of phase two. The legislature, the 2006 legislature, also appropriated funds to design the second phase of the expansion at Moose Lake. Phase two will provide an additional 400 new beds for the sex offender program, and it will also provide the necessary support space such as recreation, industry, dietary, warehousing, education, and programming space to support the new 800-bed capacity developed with both phase one and phase two. Construction documents, plans, and specifications are complete for phase two and are ready for going out for bid. Construction contracts for phase two could be awarded in approximately 6 weeks after we would go out for bid. So if we would go out for bid next week, we could have the project awarded in approximately 6 weeks, and we could start construction probably 3 or 4 weeks after that. The governor did not recommend funds for capital funds for this request in the 2008 budget. He has included a budget planning estimate of approximately $100 million to be included in the 2010 project capital budget request. The department's second project, or second priority, was system-wide asset.
Can we just have questions between each project? What is the anticipated population of the sex offender program between now and 2010, when the governor had indicated he might include this in a bonding proposal?
Madam Chair, our current population is around 420 patients. By July of 2010, that is expected to the bed capacity needed is expected to grow to 628. We're growing at a rate of about 60, over 60 a year. That is projected to grow to over 70 a year in the out years.
Now, we're painfully aware of this. So, and what is the bed capacity that you have available to you now?
Madam Chair, we have approximately 500 beds available to us now. The reason I have to qualify that in this sense, the bed capacity we currently are using is at St. Peter. It is also at Moose Lake, the current facility at Moose Lake, on the sex offender on the Minnesota Sex Offender Program campus, and we are also leasing space from the Department of Corrections that amounts to about 200 beds. As we have growth in the MIND program, the Minnesota Security Hospital at St. Peter, that is taking away bed capacity from us for the sex offender program at that location. I would also add that the space that we're leasing for corrections is certainly not ideal. It doesn't have the program space available to it, and is quite expensive to our agency. It costs us about $8 million a year to use that space from corrections, because that forces corrections then to go to Appleton and expand their use of the Appleton program. So the bed capacity
is shifting. And is the Department of Corrections requesting bonding for additional space at their facility also?
Madam Chair, I'm not acquainted with the specifics of the Department of Corrections bonding request. I can get back to you on that. But I don't believe they're requesting any additional space at Moose Lake. And, again...
No, I didn't mean necessarily at Moose Lake.
I believe there was something on the table for Faribault, but I don't want to speak beyond what my information.
I mean, you know, because these things are sort of related to each other. You're leasing space from the Department of Corrections, and I'm assuming if this proposal is not in the bonding bill this year, that you would be then needing to lease more space from them. I mean, I don't know exactly otherwise where the additional beds would be found, and then they're requesting bonding to add more prison beds. That's my...
Yes. Madam Chair, I would have to get back to you on what corrections is requesting in their proposal. But in comment to that, our request that we presented here was intended to address our capacity. And our cost, I assume that what corrections, if they are requesting additional bed space, it's to address their capacity needs, not our capacity.
Well,
this is the
I
request
guess the question
ours.
Would be then, if this proposal is not in the bonding bill, would there be an ability for you to lease more bed space from the Department of Corrections?
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we would have to continue our presence at St. Peter longer than we anticipated, which is problematic on a number of levels. We would probably have to continue to lease space from corrections, and may have to expand those lease arrangements. We also have a challenge with respect to program and treatment space, as was mentioned. The space that's available to corrections to address our future demands for correction space is really Appleton. That's what was used in this situation, and I assume that's what would have to be looked at going forward.
And so then can you just tell me what happens to your operating costs of the program if you're leasing space from corrections and or remaining at St. Peter?
Yeah, Madam Chair, the purpose behind this proposal was to certainly address the bed space that we need. It was to address the program space that we needed for both the first phase that's under construction now and the second phase. It was also presented, it also met some fiscal interests as well, because absent this, we project that preliminary projections would show that we would save in operations money about $50 a day as a result of this facility, and that over a four-year period of time, between 2010 through 2000 fiscal year 2010 through fiscal year 13, we'd save around $30 million in operations expenses. That's because these buildings are designed based upon a corrections design. Right now, we're in antiquated facilities that are 25 bed units that do not have very good sight lines. This is a facility that, if you're familiar with the corrections K building, has 60 and 80 bed units that can be that can be monitored from a central location. All those units from one location. So we save significantly in operations funds as a result of the building.
And that savings would be on the new beds only or on all your beds?
Well, it would be averaged, you know, we would be having, right now we currently have 150, I believe, patients at Moose Lake. We have about 150 at the Annex, or we'll be having, and about the same amount at St. Peter. Annex is most expensive. St. Peter is the next most expensive space. And by having 800 beds at the new facility, we'll be able to save on operations cost per patient for every patient that's in that space.
And would the intention be to then phase out the Annex space if you were building the new facility, since it's the most expensive?
Madam Chair, our intent was to phase out of the Annex Annex space in the first phase. Right now, though, we're going to have to look at whether we need to remain in that space for a longer period of time if the second phase is not bonded until 2010. I don't think anybody is arguing that this isn't a critical proposal. I think that the issue has been, how does it fit with the other priorities for bonding? It's my understanding that the requests in front of the governor were about a request for about $4 for every dollar that was available. Okay. So that's really the issue. The issue isn't whether this is important. The issue is, how does it fit with everything else?
We have the same number of requests. So could you just, over one biennium, what would the reduction in the operating cost be if the new facility were created?
Well, let me just give you what our projections were when we discussed this over the four-year period. We believe that the operations savings and understand that the operations savings grows based upon how full the new facility is. The more people we have in it, as we grow in population, the more savings we get. So we would save about $3 million in 2010.
It kind of reminds me of the signs in the grocery store, you know, use your credit card to buy your groceries. The more you buy, the more you save.
Madam Chair, I guess that's correct. In 2010, we were projecting to save a little over $3 million, same in 2011. But in 2012, when we would be able to take full advantage of the capacity, the savings was around $18 million. So if you were to build this in 2010, those savings get pushed out. I think we believe that the project paid for itself in terms of debt service and principal and operations cost. Again, I'll bring it back to, how does it fit in with all the other demands for bonding dollars in a capped bonding bill? That's really what this is about. And, you know, we can talk about this in terms of department priorities, but we are not encumbered with the task that you're encumbered with or the governor's encumbered with to say, how does this fit with everything else that's being all the other needs that are here.
Right. Well, I mean, I understand that. We also, you know, on most of the days, we're not talking about bonding in this committee. We're talking about how to balance a budget.
Right.
So I think, you know, it has to be a consideration. Questions? Senator Laurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'd like, I did draft a bill and dropped it yesterday to for the full $90 million request for Phase 2 myself, and I'd like to speak to that bill at some point. I don't know if you'd like me to do that today or
this
if it
is
just
your
goes.
Chance.
Okay. I've got a copy of the bill and some of the work that the design work that has been done through Phase 1, if I could get that handed out, and just make a few points. The first issue is that the reason this was DHS's number one proposal priority in their bonding request was that public safety concerns pretty much require that we address this rapidly growing and difficult to serve population. And I think Wes Quistra's caution about the fact that we've got 65 or so patients a day right now, I mean, a year entering the program. We haven't fixed the back end of the program, where we have not been able to release any patients from this program as of yet. We have not fixed the front end in that the corrections model serves clients at about $60 a day. When they come out of corrections after their sentence is served and go into civil commitment, we have about a $360 a day cost to serve these what are now patients. And now with the lack of the commitment to finish up the plans that were put in place in 2006, we have a serious operational problem, particularly from the Health and Human Service budget side, that we need to be very cognizant of as we move forward. Phase one, as was stated, I didn't keep a copy of my thing, was 400 beds. And if you look at the back of this, it's a photocopy that is not great, but you can see a line between phase one and phase two. Phase one is really 400 beds. Wes Koester mentioned that. It doesn't include the ancillary services and the support services. We're talking about food services. We're talking about treatment space. We're talking about recreation space. Again, for people that have served their sentence. And 400 beds alone is not a hospital. So I'm not quite sure what we're going to do. I'd like to be as helpful as possible. We need to be working together to make sure that we have a plan for how to address this, again, rapidly growing population. This issue is not going to go away. I'd like to speak to, I think everybody's quite aware of the cost of delay of any project, but particularly in a project that is a secure facility, if we build phase one without having phase two in place, I'm told that there's, on top of the well-understood cost of delay of any project, there's an additional 25% cost to build within a secure perimeter, which is what we're going to be talking about if we put phase two off again. That entails, you know, a bunch of additional security work to be moving equipment and people in and out of a secure perimeter to serve the building needs of such a big project. I think another really important point is that in phase one that is going on right now, we did do the design and architectural work for phase two. They made the point that they're ready to put jobs on the street basically within weeks of approving phase two. And with our current economy and our economist telling us that lack of jobs is what has driven us to such a difficult financial situation, these should take a very high priority in our bonding requests. Another thing to reiterate is that the operational savings, about $50 plus per day per patient when averaged across all the patients, should serve the debt service and the principal payments over the time of the bonds, so that it really is a wise, and again, everybody does recognize that, I understand, but it bears repeating. And then also, from the DHS, the Health and Human Service budget side, we also need to look at the forecasts into the next bienniums. And my understanding is, as we put the forecasts together, we had anticipated, because this was a plan put together in 2006, we had anticipated these savings. And they're going to come and hit our Health and Human Service budgets even harder in the next biennium. I'm not entirely well-versed yet on exactly how that happens, but maybe somebody from DHS could help bear that out a little bit. But I've been told we need to be very aware of the increasing pressures it's going to place on our Health and Human Service operating budget if we don't act very soon.
Other questions? Okay, let's go on then.
I would actually like a little bit of comment about the out years, the next biennium and the operating budget and how that plays out, if I could get that.
Well, I guess the question could be put most simply. We have a new budget forecast coming forward in February, the end of February. since this bonding request is not in the governor's recommendation, would there be a change to the forecast then based on the fact that this project would not be online as early as had previously been anticipated?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the sex offender program appropriations are not part of the forecast. I think what Senator Lowry is referring to is that our funding for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program takes us through this, the growth that is anticipated for this biennium, and then it is flattened out in the second biennium. So the growth that is anticipated for...
But it isn't even in the forecast.
It's not in the forecast. And I think that he's referring to the pressure, the operations pressure. So when we talk about savings as a result of this structure, we're talking about cost avoidance, not necessarily savings off of current appropriations. I believe corrections growth is forecasted in part of the forecast, if I may be mistaken on that, but I believe that's correct.
Yes.
Ours is not. Ours is appropriated biennium by biennium, and then the growth in the following biennium has to be appropriated newly.
So you're suggesting to us that if we're still in a budget deficit situation in the next biennium, that we would be cutting more in order to fund additional sex offender beds?
Madam Chair, we just know the growth is 60 per year, and we don't, that growth is not accommodated in our appropriations for the for 10 and 11. We're working on, as you're aware, we're working on our per diem currently. We think we're at a high mark in the per diem because of all the transfers that we've had to accommodate and having units that we're leaving not fully populated, as well as units that we're moving to. There's a lot of reasons we think we're at the high mark of our cost per day. But given the growth of 60 to 70 a year, even our best efforts to bring that per diem down would not likely result. We would still likely have to come in with an appropriation request for the following biennium. We'll see when the numbers come in.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. My question may be taking us a little too far off of the agenda, but I am curious to know, in the context of this discussion about the long-term implications of what we're talking about in operation costs, how we compare or how are we the same or different than other states' management of this, like the state of Wisconsin? Are they experiencing the same numbers and growth, and are they managing their system in a similar way?
I wish you could have gone with us to see Sand Ridge 2 weeks ago. I guess we were there. It's really quite an outstanding program. We don't really have time to go into all the differences today, but I can tell you one difference that's striking to me is they have very few people being committed who committed crimes as juveniles, as compared to our 10 per year. They have a little smaller number per year coming in.
Madam Chair, I believe it's about 35 a year coming
right.
in.
Right. They have, at the moment, 20 that are in the fourth stage of their program, which is outside of the facility. And over the course of the life of their program, which... I can't remember what year they started, but they've had 60 that have gone into phase four altogether. So it is possible
to do it differently.
Have a program where people actually return to the community and live there safely. They do things a little differently than we do to make that possible, and I think in the days to come we need to discuss that.
Madam Chair, I could, if it's okay, I could add to the cost question, I believe, was part of that. I believe when we were there, they told us that their annual cost was around $105,000 to $110,000 per patient. That's the recollection that I have from that discussion. That is probably around the mid-range of sex offender programs. We're in the process now of trying to survey those states and find out how much is your program costing you. Without going into too much detail, because I want to respect your time, but it's an important issue, it's hard to compare apples to apples, because in our per diems, for example, it includes the cost allocation for our whole agency, includes the cost allocation for the Department of Finance and all across state government. It's everything in there. It also includes the cost of treating 50 patients in corrections that is folded into our per diem. It includes the cost we pay for jail time for people who are found to be involved in criminal activity in our programs, so that, for example, Nicollet County does not have to disproportionately pay for their jail costs just because they have our facility in their county. We do the same thing in Carleton County. So we're trying to get apples to apples. But you know, our objective is to certainly have a robust treatment program, because that's important, but we need to bring our costs down in line with where we're seeing other states, if we can get that information. But I would also mention, in sort of defense of where we're at today, we've been through 2 years or 3 years of unprecedented growth. Before 2004, we were growing at about 10 a year. Since then, we've been growing between 60 and 70 a year. That required absolute overhaul of our treatment approach and absolute overhaul of our security approaches to this. So we've been in transition. We've been moving, as I mentioned, from one unit to another, trying to make shift space, and transition is expensive. But we think that over the long term, we need to bring our costs in line with what we see other states doing. But it is a little bit of a tricky process to get those costs from other states, but we'd be more than happy to share with the committee what we're seeing as that information comes in.
I'm not sure if they were apples to apples, but their costs were lower than ours.
Yeah.
And Madam Chair, I think that's, well, this isn't the time, but I think that when there's a cost driver like this, it's consuming more and more of our resources and reducing our, and that we have to spend it because they're incarcerated or they're in hospitals.
They're committed.
That we have to have some process, and maybe there is one in place already that I'm not aware of, to really try to tackle what we need to do differently. And I'm not saying that as an accusation that's, you're not working on that, but I just think this is a huge, huge cost driver that we ought to be targeting for study and for...
Well, it is why we requested and got a joint working group over the summer on it. And it is also why we went to Sand Ridge. And so it is uppermost in my mind, and it's not an easy subject to take on. But I really, truly just have to tell you that even if we have to keep spending all of this money, we could be doing better. We could be doing better. Other questions on this proposal? If not, thank you. Why don't we continue then?
Madam Chair, members, our second project is system-wide asset preservation, safety, and security. It's a $5 million request. This project would fund system-wide asset preservation, safety, and security projects for state-operated services facilities. It includes repairs and replacements to basic infrastructure and key mechanical, electrical, utility, and HVAC systems. It addresses code deficiencies, safety hazards, repairs and replacements of roofing systems, and tuck pointing and other building envelope work, such as window replacements for energy efficiency. This request also addresses the need to upgrade fire and life safety, items like fire sprinkling installation, emergency generator installations and replacements or improvements, smoke detection alarm systems and upgrades, smoke detection alarm system upgrades and modernizations, and campus and building security, which would include access control, camera systems, alarm systems, et cetera, at the state-owned facilities. A list of the projects associated, this is available upon request, and the governor recommended $5 million for this project.
And I guess the question I have is, if we were able somehow to fund your first request but not your second request, how would you deal with the ongoing asset preservation needs for the next biennium?
Madam Chair, the list of projects associated with this request is a list that has developed over a number of years. A lot of it was be what we call deferred maintenance to address the MSOP expansion and not address this. We would have to prioritize the projects and address those what we deem most critical with available resources, and we'd have to defer the rest until 2010.
Other questions? Okay, you want to move on then?
The third project is a system-wide campus redevelopment, reuse, and demolition. It's a request for $4.5 million. It's this project request is for funds to address the disposition of surplus facilities at state, in the state-operated services system. It is a continuation of a project that's been funded in 2005 and 2006. The focus of this project to obtain funds, is to obtain funds and legislative authority to upgrade basic infrastructure needed to facilitate viable redevelopment and reuse of the Brainerd campus and to demolish buildings that are determined to be non-functional or non-contributing to the master plan solution, which we have worked together with the local community to implement. Although this project focuses on the Brainerd campus, some funds may be needed to facilitate the disposition of the remaining surplus property in state-operated services system, for instance, the Agua Ching facility. The status of the surplus disposition project, the state closed on the sale of the Wilmer Regional Treatment Center in January 16, 2006. We also closed on the sale of the Fergus Falls campus in the last week of June 2007. A purchase agreement has been signed by the state and Cass County for the sale and purchase of the Agua Ching facility, and closing is currently scheduled for the middle of April 2008. Funding of this proposal would assist in addressing the Brainerd campus and allow us to continue with the disposition of that campus.
So is this request somewhat duplicative of the Cass County request regarding Agua Ching?
Madam Chair, the amount that are the funds that we might make available for the Agua Ching campus would focus on the demolition of buildings on the campus. We have an agreement, or one of the contingencies in the purchase agreement is that we'll grant monies for the abatement of hazardous materials and the demolition of the buildings on the campus. And I'm not quite sure what's all included in Cass County proposal.
Well, I believe there is asbestos abatement in that proposal.
Madam Chair, I believe that there may be funds included in their numbers or included in their estimates for the demolition and removal of sewer and water infrastructure that the state doesn't believe would be necessary to make the facility usable for redevelopment. It's not something that's required by any.
Well, I understand that, but that's not part of the request that's before this committee. So I guess just so we can keep moving along here, maybe you could look at the request when we get to it from Cass County, and then by tomorrow you could let us know how much duplication there is between this request and that request.
Madam Chair, we have a meeting actually with Cass County after this hearing, so
all right,
we'll discuss this issue and be ready to speak to it tomorrow.
Thank you. Other questions about this proposal? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if there's a number defined in your proposal in terms of a financial amount that you're dedicating to the Agua Ching facility.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we do not have a targeted number earmarked for that. Our feeling is that once the demolition and abatement costs bids come in, that we should be within the available, the appropriated, the $4 million appropriated earlier for the Aguachin campus. But if it's $100,000 or $200,000 more than that, we'd like to be able to have the resources available to not delay that project, but to move forward. And that would be, but we're not talking about, we haven't earmarked $1 million for that. We don't think it'll be anywhere close to more than like $100,000 or $150,000 over the $4 million already earmarked for the campus.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, actually, the request is going to be for $977,000, so close to $1 million that the county has determined it's going to cost. But I think maybe we should wait until we're making that presentation to discuss that.
How many buildings are you planning on demolishing at the Brainerd campus?
Madam Chair, that changes depending on where we are, because we're still in the development of refining the master plan. But right now we have buildings 5, 7, and 19 are old residential buildings that are not, have no projected use and are really probably earmarked for demolition. We're also looking at the potential of demolishing the main power plant or the main campus support services building. That's the largest building on campus. It's 167,000 square feet. With the master plan, we really don't find viable a use for that at this point in time. So that would probably be a part of the demolition buildings. As part of that, though, that would require us to put independent heating units in the buildings that would stay. And that's part of what we're moving forward with designing, determining what the costs are associated with the installing new boilers, independent boilers for each building and air conditioning systems for each building.
Any other questions on this proposal?
Okay. Madam Chair, members, the fourth project is Anoka Remodel Miller West Building. This request is for funds to design the renovation and construction of the west wing of the Miller Building at Anoka Regional Treatment Center as a clinical training center, office, and support complex for state-operated services. Constructions for this project were to be requested in 2010. The scope of this project would involve the construction of a mezzanine, installation of windows, elevators, sprinklers, fire detection, alarm system, security systems, communications, video conferencing, mechanical, electrical upgrades to support the new use of the space and the development of the new and the development of new and additional parking to also support this complex. Upon completion of the system's transition of the adult mental health program to community settings and the disposition of the Wilmer, Fergus, Aguaching, and Brainerd campuses, most space previously used for training in outstate Minnesota will no longer be available. The development of this clinical center at the Anoka campus would provide this needed space while facilitating the joint educational relationship SOS has with the University Medical School and other metro area professional and technical colleges. Classrooms and support spaces will be specifically designed to accommodate the specialized training and any location most appropriate for it to be in close proximity to the hospital. This would facilitate the integration of theory and practice and the linking of clinician training directly to the patients. This renovated space would also act as a lab for best practices and evidence-based practices, and the facility would also provide an environment for professionals in psychiatry, nursing, social services, psychology, program administration, and support functions to learn in a clinical environment. Our request is for $380,000. The governor did not recommend capital funding for this request.
And where is the training taking place now?
Madam Chair, we still have some space at Brainerd. We do some training there. We also rent space, or at least not lease, but rent space at different facilities in the St. Cloud area. So there's an ongoing cost for providing these spaces when we have this training and the different meetings and seminars that go on for our operations.
Any questions about this proposal? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members?
Jim from County. has a couple of proposals. So it looks like we're going to begin with the Hennepin County Medical Center request. That's what's on the screen if you're planning to use the PowerPoint.
Madam Chair, committee members, good morning. My name is Michael Belzer. I'm the medical director of Hennepin County Medical Center. Next to me is Mike Harristall, who's the Vice President for Public Policy. Hennepin County Medical Center is 120 years old this year, and we're very proud of our institution in downtown Minneapolis. We're here to talk to you today about a proposal for our Hennepin Health Sciences Education Center and the specific bonding request for $28 million to meet the needs of the medical center in our educational program. You're very aware of the role that we play with emergency preparedness. We were there when the 35W bridge collapsed. You're, I am sure, aware of our Level 1 Trauma Center, our Burn Center, our commitment to the underserved, and what is less known is our ambitious commitment to medical education, not only for physicians, and not only for licensed independent practitioners, but 30 or 40 allied health professional and dependent allied health professional providers that I'll talk about in a minute. Because of our constant need for expansion of our clinical services, we have been slowly occupying educational space as we expand our inpatient and outpatient facilities. And at the present time, we are finding ourselves very short of educational opportunities for the large number of trainees that are on our campus on any one day. The project scope involves basically two aspects. One is an education center. An education center would be a state-of-the-art learning center that would take a place of our large auditorium that we needed to move because of expansion of our psychiatric crisis center, our 24/7 acute psychiatric services center. It would have classrooms and auditorium, training rooms, laboratories for simulated training, and would hopefully be a state-of-the-art education center for all our health professionals. Additionally, as you could imagine, a teaching program that involves nurses and physicians in rounds needs to have additional incremental space for the teaching program. We need charting rooms, conference rooms, simulated call rooms, and so on. Next slide. I'm sure you're aware of the potential shortage of health professionals in the coming years. This slide shows on the upper axis, I don't have a pointer with me, the red line, the aging population of this country. The yellow line, which is stable along with the blue line, shows the consistent number of medical school and dental school or medical school and nursing graduates, which is not expected to increase much over the ensuing decades. And in the bottom line, you can see the decreasing number of physicians and nurses that are leaving the workforce because of retirement age and just the difficulty involved with those professions. Over 40% of the physicians are over 55 years of age, and we know that the major predictor of the workforce numbers is retirement from the workforce. consistently, Hennepin County Medical Center's residents. Residents are the trainees that have finished medical school and are training in a specialty prior to going out in practice. We know that consistently 55 to 65% of our residents stay in the state of Minnesota, and that number is somewhere around 70 each year. Not only do we have a large commitment to MD education in residency programs and medical school, as you can see on the left side, we have a brief listing of example health professions and a listing of institutions that we have affiliated contracts with for training their nursing students, their physician assistant students, their radiology technician students, their EMS students, and so on. Not unusual, the medical center does not capture tuition for these trainees. We do it both as a community service because they need clinical education, and we hope to gather those individuals, the best and brightest, for our training programs. In terms of nursing, we have approximately 900 to 1,000 nurses that train on our campus. The majority are RNs. Many are advanced practice nurses. In terms of our residency program, at any one time, we have 280 residents training on the campus in 24 different specialties, the majority of whom are in primary care. And we have 90 medical students from the University of Minnesota on our campus at any one time training. We have worked with Regents Hospital in a transfer for beds, an arrangement to train 9 new residents incremental to our workforce that will be meeting and training in specialties that meet the needs of our health services plan. Next slide. This is an example of our Pillsbury Auditorium that we needed to move because of the expansion of the Psychiatric Crisis Center, or our acute psychiatric services. Next slide. And we do the best we can with educational venues. This is a conference taking place in one of the cafeterias that is on the lower level of the campus. There are poor sight lines. What you can't see is, or you can in the back, there are many of the trainees that are sitting in the back of the room and I'm unable to hear or see well. We do the best we can with our space, but are in desperate need of expansion to be competitive in the market for getting residents and other trainees. Next slide. And if you just take a look at the bottom slide, this is an example of what takes place during rounds. These are physicians in training. They're examining the heart of a patient who did give us informed consent to have the trainees, and you could well imagine that this setting in outpatient as well as inpatient areas do require more room for the trainees. Next slide. We have a number of potential sites where we hope to acquire the land for our ambulatory building. The ambulatory building would be the site of our education center and the site of our outpatient clinics, and we are not at liberty at the moment to say what our major site is, and because we are negotiating with the businesses in the community. This is our medical center that's bounded by 6th Street, 8th Street, and Chicago Avenue, if you're familiar with downtown Minneapolis. Next slide. I just want to emphasize that our request is not for an entire outpatient building. The outpatient building is $175 million cost to the medical center, but only for the educational space in the outpatient building, both the Hennepin Health Sciences Education Center as well as the 15 to 16% incremental space required for teaching and teaching programs, conference rooms, and call rooms. Next. So again, as the patient, as the population of the state and country ages, there's going to be increasing need for health professionals. Hennepin County Medical Center has been and is a major player in training healthcare professionals for a variety of regions in the state and in numerous specialties, not only including MD and RNs, but many other training programs with multiple contracts with multiple clinics. Education institutions, and again to emphasize, we're asking for the educational incremental space and conference room costs for our educational center, not the entire outpatient building. Next slide. And just to remind you that Hennepin County Medical Center has been on U.S. News and World Report top hospitals for 11 straight years. We are the only hospital in the metropolitan area to achieve that outstanding achievement. Thank you.
Are there questions? I just have one comment, and that is that as we've been working on health care reform over the summer, fall, and winter, one of the things that's become abundantly clear is that we have a growing shortage of primary care physicians and nurses to meet the needs in the future. And to the extent that we do not have enough of those type of professionals, we will see increasing costs to our system. And this proposal provides training to professional healthcare professionals that serve the entire state of Minnesota. And I guess I believe that we should take this request as seriously as we would take a request from the University of Minnesota Medical School if they needed additional space. Yes, Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I just want the committee to know that in a former life I was a professor of nursing, I think you know that, and taught for Minnesota State Mankato. And in that role took students to this hospital for training. And it is a phenomenal training facility, and they do not charge the university systems for us to bring our students there. And they provide an enormous access. This is from Mankato now I'm talking about, bringing students to Hennepin County for their training. And there is, not only on the campuses, but in the institutions, a huge competition for the resource of clinical training facilities. It is one of the bottlenecks for our ability to be able to move forward and get this deficit of what the need is against what our training, what we're training, resolved in a number of ways, not only the direct relationship with the patient, but also these training facilities, whether they're on the campuses or at the institutions, for simulation and other methodologies for training. So this is a huge expense, but I think it's very serious that we pay attention to what's needed, because as the need and as the space is reduced in the hospital and we don't have the access for training facilities, we can't let people into the system for training if we don't have adequate training facilities.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I agree with Senator Sharon on that that fact. And I happen to be a co-author on this bill because I do believe in the shortage, and I do believe in this facility and the great need that is present in the state. I was a little reserved about signing on to this bill because of the fact of the great sucking sound out of rural Minnesota into the metro area, because as you know, and it's a well-known fact, that if you do your training in a certain location, the odds are you're going to stay in that area. So I am supportive of this this project, and I support it, but I also hope there is support for projects out in greater Minnesota to keep and retain our nurses and our medical facilities out there, too, because if agriculture is the number one economic driver, and the next one is our medical care out in greater Minnesota. So we have a very tough time keeping and retaining our RNs for our long-term care facilities and our hospitals and caring for our elderly. So
a lot of our loan forgiveness does go to support people in rural Minnesota, and I've always been very supportive of that also. It's important. Any other questions? Yes, Senator Sharon.
Just to follow up with what Senator Rosen is saying, I couldn't agree with this more. I support this concept, not just in this instance, but there will be, this theme of needing training centers, science centers, simulation training for healthcare professionals is going to come from lots of places throughout the state, and it's a need in lots of places throughout the state, including here in this request.
Any other questions? Senator Olson, do you have a question?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to add a comment. I'm impressed with the presentation and the comments made by the other senators. I wanted to learn some more about this before really taking a position or knowing what I would think about it, because I share those same concerns. The problem that we have in attracting and keeping doctors in rural Minnesota is partially about the training. It's also partially about reimbursement rates, and low reimbursement rates being a problem. And so it's a complex issue, as you very well know. And I guess I would just also ask for balance to make sure that we're addressing all of those issues, reimbursement rates, training, so that we do have access around the state to the same quality of care and make sure that everyone has access to the type of medical professionals they're going to need.
Senator Solon?
Madam Chair, just to elaborate a little bit, I sit on the family practice board in Duluth, and we have been studying following where our physicians go. And we know that the family practice physicians that train in rural settings stay in rural settings, even though the reimbursement is lower. That is an issue, but they become accustomed to the practice there and the quality of life there, and they appreciate it. But if we send our family practice residents into Hennepin County or to the metro area, we lose them. They do not come back to the rural area. So it is a concern, and we recognize that there's a great need in the metro area. But we have a great need also in the rural areas to maintain our physicians and our RNs.
Other questions? Okay. Let's continue then with the second request from Hennepin County.
Can I just turn it off?
Madam Chair, committee members, good morning. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. I'm Kathy Tenbrook. I'm the coordinator to end homelessness for the City of Minneapolis and Hennepin County. And this is Matthew Ayers. He's program analyst for our Office to End Homelessness in Hennepin County as well. In 2006, in alignment with the state's business plan to end long-term homelessness, leaders and community stakeholders in Hennepin County came together as a part of our Commission to End Homelessness and created our 10-year plan for ending homelessness in the community, and that plan is called Heading Home Hennepin. The plan was unanimously approved by the City of Minneapolis and Hennepin County and is now our blueprint for how we're going to move forward addressing homelessness over the next 10 years. We have just completed our first year of implementation involving hundreds of partners, and the plan is very much on track and going well. The key elements of the plan include homeless prevention, outreach, supportive housing, and access to services. And these are all critically important, but today I'm here to talk about an innovative way we plan to increase access to services to help people escape the cycles of homelessness. We know that ending homelessness for people is both the right thing to do and also cost-effective. We have some very compelling data in Hennepin County about the public costs of a very small number of people who are our most frequent users of homeless shelters, corrections, and detox. I believe it's on page 4 of your handout. These millions of dollars that we spend on just these 266 people over 5 years is just one example of how very costly to the public systems the cycling and repeated use of services can be for people in the system. Our plan is specifically focused to break these cycles and to end that level of homelessness. Over the past year and a half, we've been doing an innovation in Hennepin County called Project Homeless Connect. Project Homeless Connect is a one-stop shop service event for people experiencing homelessness or who are precariously housed. The idea is that instead of having to have people travel all over the community to get the services they need, one place to get their housing needs met, a different place for benefits, another for medical, etc., that we bring all of those services together under one roof and people come to one location to get connected to those services. There are some pictures of Project Homeless Connect in your materials as well. We have over 100 different service providers attend these events, providing housing, employment, education, veteran services, medical care, social security, identification, mental health care, dental, eye care, early childhood programs, et cetera. We've held 4 events so far, and at the last event in October, we served about 1,800 people, men, women, children, and youth, experiencing homelessness or very, very near homeless. Project Homeless Connect has been an overwhelming success. We've broken down lots of barriers for people. We have ended their homelessness in many cases. And in St. Paul, Duluth, and other rural locations, they have begun doing this, these Project Homeless Connect events as well. Connections that would normally take months for people to make happen in mere hours at these events. And just one quick example, one quick story. There was a man who came to one of our events. He had serious and persistent mental illness. He had been homeless for many years. He came to the event saying, I need to get housing. So we sat down with him. We did an intake. We connected him to housing providers at the event who had housing for people with serious and persistent mental illness. They said, this is a great fit. However, we need to have you have a mental health evaluation and a signature from a doctor before we can move you in to the housing that's available. So because they were at this event, they could literally stand up, walk across the room to the mental health section, get a mental health evaluation, get the signature he needed, and he moved in that day. And those are the kinds of things that really, for those of us who've worked in this field for a long time, know take a very long time to achieve for people. And that happened just in hours at this event. So during the development of our 10-year plan, we surveyed people who were experiencing homelessness to find out what they wanted to see in the plan, what they thought was most critical. Of course, their number one need is housing. And so, you know, above and beyond all else, housing is critically important. But they also said that they would like to see a Project Homeless Connect event on a daily basis, that this was exactly the kind of opportunity they wanted to connect to. They didn't want to see more drop-in centers where they simply could sit and have coffee. They wanted to go someplace where they could truly have access to education, jobs, housing, medical care, and really get back on their feet. So this led to our recommendation in the plan of these opportunity centers. They're one-stop shop locations in our community available on a daily basis that provide multiple services, basically co-locating services in one place to help people break down the barriers to getting those services. And just like Project Homeless Connect, those services include job training, housing, medical, dental, veteran services, substance abuse, mental health care, legal services, and population-specific services like prenatal care or early childhood education, et cetera. This concept of the Opportunity Center is not new. It's happening around the country in other locations and in locations that are getting good results. We simply know that Project Homeless Connect has been a breakthrough for us in terms of helping people connect with services, and we want to take that breakthrough and give it, bring it to a larger scale to serve more people on a regular basis. So what we're proposing is innovative in that we'd be the first in the nation to develop 3 separate population-specific opportunity centers that are coordinated with each other to maximize access for all groups, so single adults, families, and homeless unaccompanied youth. We believe that this is the most effective way to serve these guests and less expensive in that we would work with existing agencies and existing locations to keep costs as low as possible. We're currently drafting a solicitation of interest to identify potential partnering agencies. And there's already much interest in this on the behalf of providers in the community. We're also partnering with the University of Minnesota School of Design and Dean Tom Fisher, who is helping us assist us with designing the rehab necessary and potential new spaces in existing locations that would accommodate opportunity centers. We are estimating a total of all 3 locations, the cost being approximately $10 million. Hennepin County has already committed $2.5 million in their capital improvement project for this purpose, and we're asking the state to match that amount, which will then help us go out to the private sector to leverage the balance. Ending homelessness, we know it's going to take multiple strategies, but breaking down these service barriers is certainly a critically important part of that, and that's what we're aiming to do with these opportunity centers. So thanks so much for the opportunity to be here and present this information, and we're both available if you have any questions.
Are there any questions? I guess not. Thank you very much.
Thank you
and
very
good
much.
Luck to you. The next presentation is from the Tubman Family Alliance Violence Prevention Center.
Good
Welcome, Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair and division members. We're here today to request bonding for $3.1 million as a part of a visionary $12 million project that would create a family violence prevention and research center in Maplewood. Right now, the Tubman Alliance provides a safe haven for 25% of the abuse victims, persons in Minnesota that need shelter. Maplewood and Minneapolis would be a part of that 25% through this proposal. I know each of you is very aware of the problem of domestic violence, and we're reminded of it in the recent tragedy of the four-year-old died in Minneapolis through a caregiver. And going in the north wing of the Capitol on this floor, if you haven't seen the T-shirts from the victim, relatives, and others, just read one from Bacchus of the family, but they're all over the cities, rural, suburban, those stories. And this, the need you're aware of. We've had victims in my own district. This proposal is a result of the sisters at the St. Paul Monastery through their vision, living their vow of what they could do to transform the facility, which some of you have had a chance to visit, to transform that vision into the reality of a state-of-the-art center to address needed services. With me today, I have the director of the Tubman Alliance, and Bev Tusso and Randy Shubrings here to provide additional insights as to the proposal. And we appreciate very much your willingness to take time to review it. I will point out that the issue of the local government sponsor is still in discussion with Maplewood, so that has not been connected yet, but the need is clear. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wieger, for your support. We appreciate it. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Beverly Dusso, the Executive Director, and I want to thank you for your time and listening to this project. I'm very pleased to present to you such a unique project, and I hope you'll understand that when I'm done with these few comments. Because time is brief, I'd like to lift up just three key reasons why our plan to rededicate this facility, which was actually designed to last 200 years. It's only been used for 45. And it was designed as a very peaceful residence and a place for community. We'd like to move that into the most comprehensive, safe, and healing domestic abuse shelter, service center, and research learning institute in the state of Minnesota. This building will provide, first, safety and stability for nearly an eighth of this specific building. Would provide safety stability for nearly an eighth of the state's victims of domestic violence and their children. Second, economic and financial soundness resulting from the best and most effective use of state and private dollars in service excellence and delivery. And third, the creation of a learning institute to discover, test, practice, and share the smartest and most effective means to build safe and healthy families and communities. Safety is the first issue. Safe, safe, safe. Converting a monastery into a family shelter, a monastery is no ordinary building, nor is a family abuse shelter and service center. Both must provide far more than simply refuge. For families marked by violence, the sooner they can achieve a safe, stable environment that supports their need for physical, emotional, and spiritual healing, the better they're able to create their new lives. And they tell us that all the time. The children who are victims or witnesses to abuse have a much greater chance to resume a normal childhood and break the generational cycle of violence if we get to them quickly. And because recovery from this trauma has so many dimensions, it occurs best in an environment where the individual's and family's needs can be addressed intensively and holistically quickly. Everything you just heard in the report from Hennepin County about those who are homeless, simply overlay into my remarks without my repeating them, because their rationale, and this one, I believe, holds the same water very well. This remarkable facility pictured above was built of poured concrete, cement, stone, and brick to last. It was, in fact, Ramsey County's bomb shelter until about a dozen years ago. This is safe by definition. But it was designed as a refuge and a peace-filled residence, a retreat and a community place, and is ideally suited to reach families fleeing violence and trying to seek and build a new and normal life. The monastery building meets these needs extremely well. First, it's located on a major bus route in the center of a suburban community, which dramatically improves what a woman can do in terms of access for herself and for her children. Second, its proximity to planned affordable housing and an on-campus daycare center means that the families have many more ways to complete their transition from shelter into real life. That's what we all want, lives just like us. And third, the residential wing offers secure family living on a scale much like a college dorm, if you think of the feelings there. There are 5 residential floors, each with 1, 2, and 3-room suites. Each has a kind of a shared community kitchen and a great room and laundry facilities, the things that actually, well, think of your own neighborhood at home and what we like to do with our buddies and friends with over coffee and going out to the grocery store. It's all there. Each floor as well, of course, will have its own staff. And it's Minnesota, a screened-in porch. It is, we believe, the second key reason for this, very financially sound. Soundness must be as we work forward in any human service activity. For our clients, access to effective services for the agency, economic viability, and finally, the third reason is because we think it'll improve our capacity to be excellent stewards of public and private funders. All of these are essential as they consolidate our 3 scattered programs across our East Metro area into 1 comprehensive and efficient service site. So the first is access to services. First, as you heard before, multiple services for both our clients and for the partners that work with us in serving them. You know, it means if you're scattered all over the place, more management, more staff, and more rent. All of those get reduced here. And one example for the clients is the lack of convenient public transportation means our staff has to drive them everywhere, which means they're not in the shelter helping the other residents. Our other partners, of course, face exactly the same problems with transportation when you're scattered in places where there is not some public transportation. But in this integrated model, social workers, nurses, advocates, police and court officials, all will be able to work with families together and effectively, also reducing overall society's costs for all of these services. We will devote a full floor in the residential wing to client services that are all combined so they have seamless access to whatever they need, whatever their goals are, so they can get on with life and come back to something normal. In terms of economic viability, in real dollar cost savings, and we have reprojected this over and over, it appears we will save over $100,000 annually by getting rid of the 3 sites and putting all of these activities into this 1 extraordinary site. This is my 7th building, and this to me is a flat-out miracle, but I keep doing the numbers, and they keep coming out the same. So I've got to believe they're pretty on track. It means serving more families in the community from a walk-in perspective as well. Better savings, better access. And finally, being good stewards means, because our mission is so well aligned with the Benedictines, they've offered us this amazing facility for approximately 1/6 its value. That's saving about $10 million. In terms of leveraging facilities and saving something remarkable in this state, it's a stunning deal. There, people will find not only shelter, but family violence prevention programs, legal services, counseling, family support, and health care on 1 campus on the border connecting 2 counties. We hope to do lots of joint work with both of those counties, which we've served for over 25 years directly. We'll move Tubman's headquarters as well from its Minneapolis site currently, because we need more program space there, to the Monastery Center, as well as the Legal Service Center. The last and most important thing is the Institute. This new regional center, we hope, will influence systems, will influence practices, and will influence learning. What we mean there is this: with regard to systems change, to achieve a vision of a safe and healthy family, community, and individual place, we must address systemic issues when we're trying to transform people's lives. We're excited about how this new center will extend the impact of our research and establish a new model for collaborative, cross-disciplinary work, not just involving experts from psych and soc, but thinkers from as diverse fields as economics, healthcare, child development, and even public policy. All this will better integrate and make more efficient systems. And we know we must do that. We must join together on every front possible. Second, the Learning Institute itself. We already have a respected intern program for undergraduates all the way through postgraduates. They come to us again: social work, psych, law, public health, public affairs, child development, and chaplaincy, among others. But we need to extend this and include it by joining these non-traditional fields together to study and test best practices. There is space in this building to make those things happen. And we will go forward with the professors that we have in institutions across the metro area, but we hope, and I dream, that it will extend it both online and on site, both nationally and possibly even worldwide. We've already presented in Russia and Ireland and Bali. So we know that we have some international influence, and we hope to expand it. Finally, in terms of reducing cost to society, by identifying with researchers the most effective ways and the most effective methods to spend the few dollars that we have, we believe we can make the work we do more effective and that we can share the learning both statewide and nationally. Our field is young. It's only about 30 years old. It needs to go a long way. But if we can stop consuming dollars for victims, maybe we can put them into helping those who are abusive so that we can stop the abuse in the first place. So what is all this? We hope is safe, sound, and smart. We hope that we are helping families. We hope we help the agency, and we hope we can extend dollars and learning in such a place as this. And we hope you'll agree that state investment in these three goals will be very useful as you think about the use of bonding money this cycle. Thank you for listening to us.
Are there questions? Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, well, first I want to thank Senator Wieger for what I think he always does a tremendous job for his constituents, and so I thank you publicly for that. And I thank the testifiers, and I will just say that I was out at this site and took a look at it, and I hesitate at all to say no to this after the sisters have been praying for 14 years, and so I hesitate not to support this project. The good Lord's on this one side, I'm sure of it. But I want to just tell you, I think you've got a great project, and thank you for your testimony.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Next, St. Paul Gillette Hospital.
Chair and members, thank you for allowing me to come before you again this morning. The request that I'm bringing before you is a request from Gillette's Children's Specialty Care for planning and design money. As most of you know, Gillette's used to be a state-owned hospital in 1980. The state transferred ownership to Gillette, and they have been providing care for severely disabled children and doing a wonderful job of bringing these children to a more normal life. They do have needs as they do a major renovation. They're in their phase two of a major renovation to upgrade their facilities. And we have a request here for some planning and design money. I'm here this morning with Margaret Perryman. She's the chief operating officer or executive officer of Gillette's, and she would like to provide you with additional information.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for this opportunity to present our proposal to you. I have with me this morning, too, Catherine Wardrop, who's our Vice President of Strategic Planning and has been coordinating the work to come here to you today. First of all, just a little bit of background about Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare. We were founded in 1897 as a state institution. As we've evolved in 1887, our job was to take care of children with disabilities, and here in the year 2008, that's still our job. We take care of the children with disabilities from around the state of Minnesota. Last year cared for 20,150 children. We have a map, first of all, showing the facilities that we operate. We actually do a lot of work out in greater Minnesota. We have trucks that travel to those facilities or into those communities and help take care of children in those communities, as well as we have our location in St. Paul. We have a clinic in Burnsville, a clinic in Minnetonka, and a clinic in Duluth. on the second page of the handout, we've listed the counties in Minnesota and the number of patients that we see from each one of those counties. And we do see children from every county in the state of Minnesota, and hopefully you'll find the county and the number of children that we care for from your community. We also listed the types of diagnoses and the number of patients that we have seen with those diagnoses in the year 2007. And we did this partly to help you understand what we mean when we talk about children with disabilities and how we are really very focused in a patient population that is not being cared for because of the expertise required in most in the other children's hospitals in our state, as well as in the facilities, other hospitals and resources available in our state. This patient population has very unique and complicated needs, and we at Gillette have been able to pull together a team of experts focused on these particular needs. I also have a chart that outlines the blue line is the state demographer's estimate of the number of children ages 0 to 19 up into the year 2015. I wanted to demonstrate that our patient population has continued to grow even during the time when the actual population of children has dropped in our state. And now with an expectation that the number of children will be growing based on the state demographer's estimate, this also defines for us an increased need, because we expect that some percentage of this population will be children with disabilities, and therefore we need to meet the growth that's anticipated. And then on the next page, I have a more defined description of the facility work that we've been attending to at Gillette over the last, both the previous and then into the future. Phase one is outlined here, is a project that we are right now doing ourselves, and this is some remodeling of some existing space, as well as acquisition of 23,000 square feet from Regents Hospital in order that we could then use that space for clinic space as well as advanced imaging. The space we want to we are asking for a planning grant to support is that phase two project, 33,000 square feet of new space for our operating rooms. This is space that we'll be able to acquire from Regents, but will need to be remodeled to accommodate the very special needs of children with disabilities who are having surgery, as well as the need to expand our number of square footage that we have available for clinic space and other support space. And then finally, some renovation of our inpatient space. This is the space. This phase two is the project that we would like planning money to support the development of this space. We also have listed here a phase three, which is out beyond the year 2013, that we expect we'll need to address. And then on the next page, I just have a clearer idea of what phase one, phase two, phase three is, and approximately what cost. So phase one, the project that we're working on right now, we, Gillette, have funded 100%. And then phase two is the project that we would be looking for planning money. That would begin in 2010. And then finally, we have a Gantt chart just to show how these phases line up over the next several years. And then finally, we have a description of the space or of the location where this expansion would be put. This is University Avenue is, labeled here on this chart. And then this is land that we actually own across the street from Regents Hospital, and this would be the space that would have the bulk of the expansion project that we're talking about located on it. And then finally, we have an architectural rendering of what the space might look like on University Avenue. Anybody have a question?
Madam Chair.
Questions? Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, I just want to say that, well, first I want to thank Senator Scully and I want to thank Margaret, and sorry about calling you by your first name, but I just I consider you a friend, and I appreciate the hard work that you're doing. I've been over and taken a tour, and I've actually heard from several of my constituents on how important Gillette Children's Hospital is. And I would just point out to the members that, you know, a lot of these projects are kind of, in a way, regional, or they're kind of what they call local projects. And I know the chairman has told me, Senator Langstedt says, no local projects, which I don't like to hear that, because really, in essence, a lot of these are almost all local projects. But I will say that this project is not a local project. This is a Minnesota project for the entire state. All you have to do is look on here, and it affects each and every one of our districts. I believe that this should be ranked very, very high, and it certainly will be ranked very, very high in my ranking of projects. And I just want to thank all the people that are here that are involved with Gillette Children's Hospital, because, and I've said this before, you know, people say our environment is our most important asset. Well, I disagree with that. It's important, but our most important asset is our children, because they're the ones that are going to be sitting in these chairs after we're dead and gone, and they're going to be taking care of us when we get old. And so it behooves us to take care of our children so that they'll be willing to take the reins in the future. So, again, I just want to thank you for your hard work, and thank Senator Scoy, who does a fine, fine job, and really appreciate it.
Ms. Perryman, would it be your intention, if the planning grant money is funded, then to come back and ask for capital construction dollars in the future?
Madam Chair, yes, we would. Probably in 2010, come back to talk about or with a request for capital expansion dollars.
Any other questions? Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Perryman, just a curiosity. Do you have an understanding of why, as the children's population has decreased, your patient population has increased?
Yes, I think for a number of reasons. Most specifically, I believe that we over the last 15 years have very much focused on the needs of children with disabilities and added more additional resources, new physicians, new nurses, nurse practitioners who could better meet those needs. In addition, we've also added some additional facility, which then has increased the access, the availability of those services, and so then therefore more children are able to be met or are able to be cared for by us. We have not significantly changed our mission. We have not changed our mission. We have continued to take care of children with disabilities through all of those years, but I believe the increased access, increased availability of people with expertise has just drawn more children in their care.
Madam Chair, just to follow up. So not necessarily an increase in disease or disorder.
Well, you know, thank you very much for reminding me of that. In addition, the incidence of children with disabilities has actually increased over the last 10 or 15 years. Much of that is because we're doing a better job of saving children and prolonging their lives. And, you know, that's a good thing because a lot of children who now we care for our children with cerebral palsy, and these are children who have great promise in the world. And so our colleagues in the newborn intensive care units have been able to save very small babies. About 10% of those very small babies may end up having cerebral palsy, but then with proper medical care, children with cerebral palsy grow up to be adults and participate fully in the world. So,
thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Then the next proposal is the Agua Ching redevelopment.
Thank you very much.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm here today with a request on behalf of Cass County for $977,500. I don't think on the original document or the proposed bill presented to you we had a number, but we've been working, and Cass County has been working diligently to have as fine-tuned a number as possible to present here today. As you know, Madam Chair, with the state's decision to close Agua Ching, approximately 300 jobs in the Walker community were lost. Agua Ching was the largest employer in the area by far, and the closing of this facility has really had a devastating impact on the Walker economy. Thankfully, though, and very much the county very much appreciates the state's decision to work with the county to allow the county to purchase this facility and really make this into a win-win situation for the community with the plan for a hospital to be located at that site together with some complementary buildings. A lot of obstacles initially stood in the way, and one of those was the problem with the proximity of the hospital to the hospital in Park Rapids. But just in the last month or so, that impediment has been resolved, and the federal government has now reevaluated their formula and has given the green light to this project. At the same time, just last week, the county received notice from the state that they're now planning to vacate this property as of March. And so since the initial funding or decision was made in 2004, the county is now on the brink of finalizing a purchase agreement with the state to go ahead and kind of seamlessly take over and begin immediately the work on the hospital project. The problem is that since the time when the initial estimate of costs for asbestos removal and demolition was made at $4 million. The actual cost is approximately $977,000 more than what was initially anticipated. And some discussion or reference was made to that by the department in their earlier presentation. But I'd like to at this time turn the microphone over to County Commissioner Jim Demjan to discuss the reason for that additional cost and some of the difference in number between how the county sees this and what you heard earlier from the department. And also with me here today is the county administrator, Mr. Bobby Oakham, who's also available for any questions you might have.
Madam Chair and committee members and Senator Olson, thank you for having us here today. we're very interested in taking over that site. The reuse study, if you look back on some of the literature we passed out to you in 2004, said the best use for that area is for a hospital, critical care hospital, and for county government someday maybe to relocate on that site. And if you look at the first page, under the title page, it shows a master plan of the area where the hospital and maybe county government or future buildings will be sited. The demolition, to us, it's very valuable to get everything off that site before the county takes it over. We appreciate the state working with us on that, and we do need that money. There's some hidden things on that site. There's tunnels between buildings on the existing site where the hospital is, and we feel for us to use that and to cut the liability on our taxpayers in the county is to get all of those things removed before we take it over. That is one of the big reasons for the increased cost of $977,500. They're looking at March of closing. March 14th has been a date, and they would like to pass it on to the county before the end of April or approximately the end of April. So that's why we're addressing this right now. I'd open it up to questions, and Bob Yoakum, our county administrator, can field a lot of those questions if I can't.
Are there any questions? I guess the main question I had, I already asked the department, and since you'll be meeting with them, we'll expect to kind of get that sorted out and brought back to our committee by tomorrow.
Madam Chair, if I may, just to focus on the respectful difference of opinion has to do with the amount of demolition of buried utilities that, if disturbed through a construction project, a future construction project, would be regulated material and would have to be disposed of. And that estimate in the consultant's work to date is as high as $1,600,000. And we will be working with the department and have been working with both Human Services and Admin to make sure that we are we're removing those underground elements that would be significant impediments to future construction, but to leave other underground infrastructure in its place if it doesn't need to be disturbed. That is the issue. To give you an idea of the scope, there's 18 major buildings at Aguacheng, and our working estimate is that there is approximately 38,000 lineal feet of tunnel systems, and materials, if disturbed, have friable asbestos and therefore are regulated materials and have to be dealt with if they're disturbed. So the scope of this underground demolition really is the issue. Other elements of the project are not in dispute, and we've had excellent cooperation from a number of departments. But we do need to address that, and we will report back. I'd also like to mention very quickly that we are providing testimony on Senator Tomasoni's committee this afternoon with respect to the utility aspect of reusing this site. Thank you.
Would the presence of these underground utility lines prevent the closing of the property in March?
It would be a great chance that the county board would not accept the property, yes. Because of, you know, not knowing what's there. Mm-hmm. You fear the unknown for your constituency.
And then would the hospital not proceed?
Madam Chair, as this committee may recall, the long-term care license moratorium exception is unique to the Aguacheng site. The hospital moratorium exception that this committee and the legislature granted is Aguacheng or within 25 miles. The the radius reference to Agua Ching was only as a backup plan if we were unable to get either a congressional act or a departmental waiver. All of the studies and indeed the proposal from the Benedictine Health System, now Essentia Health, which is a $34 million commitment to our community, that is specific to Agua Ching. And in my judgment, it would significantly delay or eliminate that project. It certainly, in terms of the other public reuse of that area, that would, of course, would be a county board decision. But any buyer, our position is any buyer is going to need to address this, whether it's Cass County or the private sector. Somebody is going to need to address this element to the satisfaction of the buyer to potentially reuse this site.
But we don't really know if there'll be any expansion of the hospital. I mean, the whole idea was the hospital facility was going to be a small facility.
Madam Chair, we have a live proposal from the Benedictine Health System with several contingencies. One of the contingencies is the availability of this site for construction of a hospital, 15 beds, as I recall, and a medical office clinic. That is a proposal on the table to the Cass County Board.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And having met with some of their representatives, in order to make the hospital a viable project, there's also on site a plan for long-term care and assisted living facilities that would complement the hospital project. So we're not just talking about underground utilities. We're also talking about tunnels, because there were apparently extensive tunnels between buildings. And there, as Mr. Yoakum has said, there's asbestos and other concerns that would have to be addressed no matter who buys this, as well as just not being able to leave the site kind of with a network of underground tunnels that can't be just ignored, because eventually there would be safety issues there as well. So really the question is, in terms of what does demolition and returning the site, dealing with the infrastructure to return it to a usable purpose, what does that mean? And the idea is to allow the county to go forward or to work with Benedictines and make this a viable project for them. If this expense had to be borne by the county, as you know, Senator Berglund, Cass County is one of the poorest counties in the area, and the resources to do this, just even though it's a relatively small amount of money in comparison to the whole project, for the county to have to come up with this money is something that they're not saying that they would be able to do. They just, for the second time, tried to get a school referendum passed just yesterday. That went down, even though there's a desperate need there for additional funding in schools. So, you know, it's really just a small amount of money, but it's really key to moving this project forward.
Any questions? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, and to your testifiers, I think at the beginning of your testimony you indicated that part of the reason you were here and looking at reusing this particular facility was the significant job loss that your community experienced, and I think it was 300 jobs. I wonder if you could offer to the committee what you think that this reuse plan will do in terms of jobs for your community.
Madam Chair, the projection for the hospital project phase one, the hospital and medical office clinic, is 150 permanent new jobs to our area. The combined construction impact between the county and the Benedictine system would be about $30 million. So we would have construction-related jobs at that level, and then followed by our projection of 150 jobs. And we do have extensive studies available from outside sources to document that.
Any other questions? If not, thank you very much. I'm going to ask if we could just stay for the last presentation here, because I'm not sure if they can come back tomorrow. And that is the West Central Secure Treatment Facility.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And committee.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee. Thanks for staying and giving us a few minutes today. The bill before you is Senate File 1742. It is a bill that is familiar to this committee. We presented it last year, and it was in the bonding bill last year that got vetoed. And then we have met with Senator Berglund during the interim and again had a discussion about this bill. It appropriates bond money for DHS to do a pre-design on a multi-county secure treatment facility, and also directs the commissioner to prepare a report assessing the need and viability of that kind of a facility out in West Central Minnesota. 11 counties for 2 years have held together on this project, and that's difficult in any part of the state to get 11 counties to agree on something. And for 2 years, they've put in their own time and money. And now we're to the pre-design phase. And so we're asking for some bonding money of $300,000 to see if this is what we really should be doing in this 11-county area. I have with me today a couple of people who have been in and on this project. They are Joyce Pesch. She is a social service director in Grant County, and also Riaz Aziz, who is a coordinator in Pope County. And we gave you some handouts that you can look at, too. Ultimately, we're going to request that this project be included, of course, in the bonding bill. And before I turn it over to Joyce and Riaz, these counties are doing what I think the state has encouraged, and that is take a regional approach to some of this stuff. And in this particular case, it's how to deal with people who are coming through our judicial system, and while they wait to get sentenced or shortly after their sentencing, what kind of treatment are they receiving, and what kind of analysis is being done on their state, so that eventually we can put them back out and they're productive members of society. And I think this 11-county consortium has struck upon something that might work, and we need to find out if we can take it to the next step. So with that, I'll turn it over to our presenters. They have the information. They can answer your questions.
Thank you.
Just identify yourself for the record.
Okay. Madam Chair and committee members, I am Joyce Pesch. I am the director of Grant County Social Services and have the privilege of having held that position for over 20 years. I'm here today, as indicated, to ask for your support for this project in the bonding bill. My role today, I see, as helping you to understand the social services aspect, the treatment aspect, that is a dual portion that goes along with the facility itself. When I believe when we talk about the pre-design, we're talking actually two things. We have this concept. We've worked hard on it. We need to continue to pursue the details of what the treatment portion will look like and what the structure will look like, to be sure that, in fact, we have a model that is the most workable we can create to fit this unique niche of individuals that are not currently receiving treatment at the earliest possible point in time. My office does the Rule 25 assessments for the courts in Grant County. And so because all of the intake in my office at some point in time crosses my desk as well, I see the court orders that come in telling us that this person is to have a chemical use assessment. At least 50% of those orders the person has, quote, already been sentenced, and the top portion of it is language like sentenced to a year, 30 days served, and the rest is state. To me, that means that person has already sat in a facility for 30 days before even coming to us as far as having a chemical use assessment to determine whether or not treatment is an appropriate option. The time that our individuals from any of the 11 counties spend in detention or actually spend in jail after being sentenced without an assessment for both chemical use and for mental health becomes kind of wasted time for them. The best thing we can do for our adults is also to make sure that if there is a need, it is identified at the earliest possible point in time, that we in fact offer services at a critical point in time. And for an individual who's just been picked up, who is now sitting in a cell, perhaps cannot make bail, that individual is probably at one of the lower points that person is going to be at, you know, for a significant period of time. That is an ideal time to be able to come to them and say, and we have treatment options that will help you through this. That's the point we want to reach out to this group of underserved individuals. The other piece, and I can say this because I come from a small county, I can't do something like this alone. I don't have the critical mass it takes to put enough people together under one roof and set up the specialty programs and the unique services that would best serve that population. I need to do that in conjunction with the other 10 counties, and we need to have all of our people in a concentrated location as opposed to scattered throughout the 11-county area. If we can't bring them together, we can't offer that unique kind of treatment that we believe can be developed to work with this particular group of individuals. And
thank you, Joyce. Madam Chair, as Senator Skogan earlier mentioned, my name is Riaz Aziz. I serve as head of administration for Pope County. They often say that trying to get two municipal jurisdictions to work together can often be challenging and maybe even a miracle. But when we mention that we've got 11 counties in our region, which includes Becker, Clay, Douglas, Grant, Otter Tail, Stevens, Todd, Travers, Vadena, and Wilkin County working together and have managed to stick through this process for the last 2 years, it is because this is an issue that is facing greater Minnesota, and it is a drain on much of our resources in that part of the state, simply because of the lack of resources being able to handle this need, of being able to take care of these individuals early into the program as opposed to much later. A number of requests that's been discussed earlier here today had to do for construction of facilities, and one of the points that we wanted to make to the board, and I'm sure you have it in the handout with you, and that is we're here seeking funding primarily for the pre-design aspect of it. We came to the conclusion very early on that we don't have all the answers. We have asked for help from Department of Corrections and Health and Human Services, experts such as Joyce and others within the 11 counties, to be able to provide us with the necessary tools to help determine if indeed this is something that can make a difference in our region. And one of the reasons for the pre-design as opposed to going forward with designing the facility is because we've recognized from the very beginning that a number of operational questions continues to exist in the procedures touching detention, courts, human services systems that will need to be coordinated and more fully understood. And it is our goal to create a new treatment environment to serve populations at a much earlier point. One of the things that Joyce alluded to is this: the current system, which brings individuals throughout our program repeatedly over and over again, misses the boat. and that is that early on, when they are at their lowest point, is when you can get to them in terms of trying to make an impact. The exact form of the service delivery is yet to be established, and the pre-design will do exactly just that. An example vision of this service delivery could be one which first supports those individuals who clearly require and voluntarily desire the treatment, Madam Chair, at the point in time that are most susceptible. And this is when they first get arrested. They are at the low point. They are likely to lose their jobs, lose their relationships, lose their identity in the community. There's a huge amount of embarrassment, not to mention, of course, fallout with regards to families in terms of school attendance, in terms of jobs, and so on and so forth, and the ability to be able to provide that program. So at this stage right now, what we are seeking the committee support is in the pre-design stage to help the 11 counties identify specifically what program will best serve this population and to then design, if you will, the bricks and mortar component that will help meet the needs of that program. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And if the pre-design is funded, would you, and you find that it's feasible to go forward, would you be asking the state then to provide bonding dollars in the future to construct the facility?
At this time, Madam Chair, the answer is yes, but with a qualifier, and that is that we have yet to determine, as part of the pre-design process, what is the role of the counties and the local communities as part of this, both in terms of the operation of the facility and also in terms of the financial responsibility part of that. So the answer to the question is yes, but we need to qualify that, and that's what we hope the pre-design will do.
Well, my comment in regard to this project, I've told you individually, and I'll say it in this meeting, is that I think that the majority of your program should be in an unlocked facility. I think the courts can refer people to treatment in lieu of sentencing, and if you have a locked facility, there's no way you're going to get any medical assistance or Minnesota Care or any other type of insurance, private insurance reimbursement for the treatment. And I realize you need to come together in order to have critical mass to do this, but your counties are not paying for treatment today while people are incarcerated, so this would be a new expense that your counties would have in terms of operation. And so it's for that reason that I really encourage you to look at whether you really need a locked facility to do this. Are there other questions? If not, thank you very much.
Chair,
yes.
Can I just point out, if as this moves forward, Senate File 1742, I do need to plug in the dollar amount. It wasn't in the original bill. And then we need to change the effective date to 09 instead of 08. I don't know.
Well, all we're doing here is having a hearing on these proposals, and then the committee will rank the proposals in terms of the order of importance the members feel and forward that in the form of a letter to Senator Langseth's committee. And so the bills are not really in this committee. They're in his committee.
Okay.
And so the action on actually amending the bill would take place in his committee.
Thank you.
All right.
Your time.
Great. Thank you very much. And thank you, members, for
your
patience with this last proposal. With that, our meeting is adjourned. Remember to leave your books here so we can load them up.